This is a recording made on February 20th, 1963, when artists Tony Leith Ross and Charles Hargens with John Richardson called on Edward Willis Redfield at his home in Center Bridge in the 94th year of his life.
I used to walk a great deal with Lathrop, you know, we went all over. One time I walked down to Trenton, and...
You couldn't get into this walking business of Kennedy's now, 50 miles.
I think they have some magnificent liars around, because I'd like to see some of these birds that walk 50 miles in a day.
Without stopping?
Twenty gives me a belly full, and I wasn't any weakling at it, neither was Lathrop as far as that went.
Well,
if you get about 20 miles under your belt, you've got some. You've generally got a blister on your foot someplace.
Our ranch in Dakota was 16 miles from town, and when I was a young fellow, every once in a while, I would walk to town. Well, now that's uphill and down and through the creeks and the canyons, and that would take a long time. I couldn't make more than about 2 miles an hour. Gait's about three.
It could
take me about 6-7 hours to walk in.
When I walked to Trenton, I went down in 5 hours. That's about pretty close on 4 miles.
Well, that's a good fast pace, you know.
Yeah, that's a good pace, but...
I remember when I was a young fellow, I had a bicycle. And I went 56 miles one day in a bicycle, but the last 2 miles I walked and pushed the bicycle.
Well, I used to be what they called a tin can racer. I'd race anything that traveled. When I had a, my wheel was geared to 84, it was racing wheel. And 2 years after I was married there, when I lived at Glenside, I went on that League of American Wheelmen run from Cam, New Jersey to Atlantic City. Now, I rode from Glenside to Philadelphia, that was 12 miles, to the ferry, and instead of going on the first division, which I thought was the Scorcher division, I took the second, see, because I didn't know how hot they were, it was a big club, they were from Philadelphia and that sort of thing. And I was very much surprised to find that the division I was on was the division that was going down in 3 hours. Running time was 3.5 hours. There was 2 15-minute stops. Now that's 60 miles. And I stayed with that, and we got into Atlantic City, I think, 10:30. Yeah, 10:30. I took a swim. I went down to Henry's house, Cincinnati house, where his father, Miss Lee, lived. You notice a different name. And he had a brother, Dr. Souther. Did you know Henry at all?
Oh, yes, I knew Henry.
Well, you know, he's very... Seeing him, you wouldn't mistake him for hardly anybody else, because his eyes slanted a little bit.
He looked like an Orient.
He had a nose kind of like that, and a thin, hatched face like that. And at one period in his life, he had these, forget what they call it, that acne rosacea, of course, that disease, that pimply, you know, left pock marks here and there. And you wouldn't take him for a beauty.
Well, he always looked all right.
Eventually, though, he became, when he carried himself erect finally, and his face was all straightened out, he was a very distinguished looking man.
Yes, he was a handsome looking fellow at a distance.
Yes.
You know, you saw him.
And I was probably his closest friend he ever had. We met in the Academy of Fine Arts together. But I went up to his house, and he said that he wanted me to meet a friend of theirs that had come up from Cape May. said that he had ridden from Camden to Cape May, then up to Atlantic City, and proposed to ride back that same day. He had a string of medals around here and all that sort of thing. And they started kidding me. He said, "Reddy, why don't you go back with him?" "Oh," I said, "I thought I did enough to ride one day." They said, "What's the matter? You're chicken? Do you don't think you can take it?" And they finally egged me on. I was going back on the 6 o'clock train. And we got out of there about 6. And he had a racing wheel. And that first stretch over to Pleasantville is 10 miles. He said, "I'll pace and you follow." And he started to pace, and he gave it, I guess, about everything he had. He'd look around once in a while, see whether the lot was paced or not. I was right with him. We got over to Pleasantville, and on the next stretch, he said, "Well, now you pace." And I said, "All right." So I went out, and I give it everything I could, hold the pace. And I lost him twice. So I slowed up, and he caught, and we got to Hammond, and he said, "I've got to have something to eat." We went in there and got a snack, and I started out on pace again. That's the last I ever saw him. I caught the 10 o'clock boat at Camden, to Camden, and again rode from there up to the house. That's 120, 30, 42, 144 miles riding. And in France, I also did some riding. I paced.
Well, where was your paint box all this time, I wonder?
Oh, I didn't take it.
Oh.
Good. Look, I've always, the thing I was doing was rather different from what any of the other men were doing.
Yeah.
And nearly everybody was making sketches.
Yeah.
Or doing as Schofield did, he didn't even have to make a sketch. He'd fake the whole darn thing up and do it very cleverly.
You mean just go and look at it?
At times he would. At other times he'd look at one of mine. He'd tell me about it too and add it around. Oh yes, he was very frank about it.
Very clever to do it.
Oh, yes. And he's a good friend and all that sort of thing. But when they steal your pattern, then you're trying... I think that was one of the worst things. Did I ever tell you about that one?
No,
I think
maybe it
is. When I first landed up here, he came up, and I told him, I said, "Every afternoon now I go out with some winter. I'm working on the river." I said, "The whole thing is different from anything I've done. You see, your towpath canal runs that way, your river runs that way, your hill runs that way, your sky runs that way, everything runs out the end of the canvases." And I said, "I'm trying to range a thing." And I said, "I want all the foreground in shadow." And I was taking a series of canvases about that large out and working at that time of the day and then just chucking them to one side, you know. And I said, "When I get that thing the way I want it, I'm going to send it to the Carnegie Institute and I'll get a prize for it." The thing was beautiful. It always is, you know, that afternoon glow. He said, "Do you mind if I go with you, out with you?" I said, "No, not at all." He had his box. He made a thing that I had around here for years. I finally burned it up. It was about like that. And that summer he went over to St. Ives. You know,
I remember he went. Colorado.
Went down to St. Ives, and Walter S. Norris of Philadelphia was with him, rather a bum painter, but a very good fellow, and an old friend of Scholes. And he made a snow thing with a glow on the back hill. He dipped the canal bank like that, as if it wasn't a canal bank, but rather like a depression or ravine went into the water. He narrowed the river. He put a cedar tree there and a big tree with some brush on this side, breaking the ends to keep the river from running out of the canvas. And then he made the back hill larger, and he got the glow on it. I was a member of the jury that year at Carnegie Institute. We used to elect the jury. And Childhassen was on, Cox, and
what Cox
Sir
was that?
Kenyon Cox?
Yeah, Kenyon Cox.
Yeah.
And Sir Alfred East, he finally became.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. But. And Schofield's picture come out. Well, here was my picture. Except that the fellow had sense enough to arrange the thing, and it was very attractive. Of course, what you feel like is just hollering, "You damn thief," or something like that, you know, but you can't do that.
Was that a big canvas?
Oh, yes.
Not the size of the original still.
Oh, it's in the permanent collection of the Carnegie Institute right now. And I saw that all the men were enthusiastic over it. And then I said, well, now what are you going to do? You going to vote for it? Or what? Are you jealous once you vote for it? You know it's a good-looking thing? Or what the hell? You have all that inner stuff going on. You know, I said, yeah, I'll vote for it. And I did. It got first prize. I could have cried, and I did cry when I come back over the old red bridge. It was that far back. Think of that fellow, a close friend of mine, I'd known, I'd really started on painting snow when he lived in Ogons. His father was going to make him work in the mill there at 6 and Clearfield Street. And I said, Sco, why don't you do snow? He went right home, didn't go out at all. He made a thing of a creek, and he sent for me then to come over and see it. I went over and saw it, very attractive, and he said, you know where I got the idea of that? I said, no, I lied, I thought I knew. And he said, well, you told me you was going to destroy that creek when you made in front of Harrison's place, where it's now Beaver College. I said, yes, I did. Well, he said, that gave me the idea, and I made it. Well, in those days, I got $150 for 2632. His was approximately that size, that particular one. He put $350 on it and sold it. The very first picture he ever painted was showed. So that's the start. Well, as a sequel to this other thing, just to show you some of the things you go through, I said, well, my God, now if I go ahead with this thing, they'll swear that I copied this from Schofield, see? So I go up on top of the hill here, back at Center Bridge, where they'd cut off most of the timber and left some stumps 2 or 3 years before. It had suckers on. And it had the brown leaves still hanging on the way they do, you know, the oaks and that sort of thing. Some rocks in it, a little laurel, some stones, and you looked at the river up that way, broad daylight, you know, not in the evening. I worked on that and I got what I thought was a corker. And I called it the Crest. And I sent it out to Pittsburgh. Schofield was on the jury. It got second. But what irritated me like hell was that the Pittsburgh papers came out and said I had evidently been influenced by Schofield's prize-winning picture of the year before. I finally told Schofield when I saw him, look, I said, brother, I said, the world's large enough without you coming in my backyard stealing the subject off me. So he got over it, though. I was just reading, searching some old letters up there, and I, what to. I wanted to tear up some things that you didn't want other people to read and that sort of thing. And I run into Schofield's letter bidding me goodbye when he joined up in England when he's 40-some-odd years old in the First World War. But he told me afterwards it was a cinch. He said all they did, he said, was to, in Belgium, was to consume vast amounts of scotch. Go up and look at the lions once in a while and come back and drink scotch.
When I was a young boy out west thinking about coming east to study art,
yeah.
I had seen some pictures of Henrys in the International Studio magazine. So I got Henrys' address somehow and I wrote a letter to him. And about 6 months afterwards, I had a reply from Ireland.
Yes.
He was living over in Ireland in a castle.
Oh, yes.
And he said, I'm writing this to you because when I was a boy, I lived in Dakota, not very far from where you are.
Lived where?
In Dakota.
God knows where he lived.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you. Henry told me that it always bothered him a lot to give the place he was born, see. And that he really was born on a boat that was bound for Cuba at sea. And that he had settled on Cincinnati. USA is a place of birth, because it didn't look very good from his point of view, say, born on a boat going to Cuba. Cincinnati was a town he picked out. Now, Mr. Lee looks if he came out of the same pod as Henry, and Dr. Southern equally so, for the same kind of features that you know that Henry had. Very distinctive, he couldn't miss it. Yet the father's name was Lee, and Mrs. Lee, of course, she's a very fine, white-haired Southern lady.
Yeah, but Lee is definitely an Oriental name.
Yes. And I've been a guest down at their house quite often, and Dr. Southern was heavier than the others, but same build. He studied medicine, graduated from Jefferson. And here was these people that all looked alike, but different names in one thing. Well, of course, I never asked him what his mission is, but I should say that he had a painter that had no love for portraits.
He painted heads.
He was, he painted them as if he was working on wooden Indians. I think any painter that paints anything must love the thing. Yeah. Henry was very short on love for anything except publicity, notoriety, and being what he termed great.
Yeah.
I say this knowing the man extremely well.
Yeah.
And he told Sloan, so Sloan said, that they lived in the West. And in a card game, Mr. Lee, in a dispute over cards, shot and killed a man. Was acquitted, tried and acquitted, and came east.
Maybe that
he didn't. Was, I think then he changed his name, possibly.
Maybe that was in Dakota.
That might well be.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact place.
Yeah.
But I have to just give you this because
yeah.
what you tell me just
yeah.
kind of brings things together a little bit.
Well, where did Bellows come in there? Was he a student of Henry?
Yes. Bellows
was?
Bellows
yeah.
was head and shoulders above any man in the eight, way and way above. He's a better painter, finer man, and what I call a good family man. Clean habits.
I lived next to him for about 8 or 9 years.
Well,
in Woodstock, New York.
Do you bear that out?
Sure, I liked him very much. He was a very able chap.
And
shame he died so young.
He studied with Henry. He originally was a professional ball player. He played ball with the Newark.
Columbus, yeah.
He might have played at Columbus,
yeah,
but he also played in Newark,
yeah,
in that baseball team. He's athletic.
He was crazy. I played a lot of tennis with him.
Did you?
Yes.
Good. So,
and with Spiker.
Yeah.
Spiker was his great friend.
Yeah, well, Spiker I didn't care for so much. I never did. I didn't think he was fine a man. I didn't think he was good a painter. He too used to slant the eyes of his portraits,
yes,
up. And
he
was a good painter, understand, but he wasn't as good as...
Bellows had much more imagination.
Look, you take that little thing that he did, or it might have been 25, 30, maybe a little larger, of his daughter in that Gramercy Park
there,
in the spring. And I won't tell you that's one handsome canvas.
Oh.
I called there with St. Gordon's to get a painting at his house there, you know. It's on the same street as Gramercy Park, I think down the end, if I remember right, more towards East River, corner property. And I was worried. I don't know why in the hell I assume that I'm a granddaddy or a father to everybody, but if I see anything that I think I can help anybody, why, I spit it out instead of keeping my mouth shut. And I said to Mrs. Bellows, I said, you told George to keep away from Henry. He's a damn sight better painter than Henry is now. And
when you went outdoors in the wintertime, how did you keep the white paint from getting hard?
Well, when it gets around 20, your paint gets so hard in the tube that in the first place you have to press very hard to get it out of your tube after it's been out for any length of time exposed. And I use poppy oil or refined linseed oil, either one or the other, and reduced it to the point of where if you were careless and slanted your palette, the whole thing would slide right off into the snow.
Would the poppy oil keep it... loose enough?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was loose enough. But the trouble was the damn stuff would slide.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a curious experience I had. During the First World War, it got so that we couldn't get that imported poppy oil and refined oils and that sort of thing. I used to deal with Taws in Philadelphia when he was on Arch Street.
Yeah, 920 Arch Street.
Yeah, for many years.
Yeah.
And he came up to see me and sat there, and I told him I was having trouble about oils. He said, look, he said, why don't you get some of this coconut oil? Cottonseed oil, I think they called it, or something like that. They used to cook with.
Yeah.
Well, he said, really, he said that, he said some are using it. He said, I think it's just as good as the other is. He said, it's a bad thing for me to say, but he said, I wouldn't be surprised what they were selling you for poppy oil. And I said to myself, well, that's all right. Try some. So I happened to have enough oil in the house at that time, and I went up, within a couple of weeks or so, to that Carversville, then, when the old mill was still there. Did you see that fort fell down? The old Stover Mill, this side of Carversville.
That was gone when I moved up here.
Boy, that was a wonder. That
you
was the handsomest thing in the
city. You made a big painting of that, didn't you?
Oh, sir.
Yes.
I sold over $25,000 worth. I just made circles around it. And I went up there, and I got all set up, and by George, I'd forgotten my mixture. I went up to that grocery store there, Watson.
Oh, yeah.
The storekeeper afterwards became the automobile dealer over here in Doylestown.
Yeah.
And I got some cottonseed oil or coconut oil, got some coal oil, and I put the two together and shook them up. And I painted a 50-56 that day. That's the largest size. That's a big size. And by George, I got it done. The paint seemed to be flatter than usual. Didn't have as many ridges in it as it had. And I brought it in, and I thought it was good. I used to criticize my own work a lot, you know, and destroy a lot of it. And I said, by George, I'll do another one. I went right back. The next day, that was taken from pretty well off. The next day, I came up close, and I looked at this end of the mill, and in the water that was there, you got the reflections of the mill, and the hills, and that sort of thing back, a little house or two. I made that knife into using the same stuff. And I thought that was the best that I had done to date. Manum, who was a pretty good critic of art in general, should always live with artists there in the hotel, a lot of painters. Why, she said, that's the best you've ever done. Now, what we used to do in those days was to ask $5,000. You'd drop dead if anybody paid you that amount, of course.
Yeah.
You you put it on because somebody else maybe put on something or other. Or it was big, and the size seemed to count, certainly in the way they hung them in shows. Anyway. It was damn funny all the way down the line. And she said, you put $7,000 on that. I said, all right. She said, I don't want to see it sold. She said, you ought to keep it. So I put $7,000 on it. And the first mill that I set, that I had made, I sent to the Corcoran Gallery of Art. And about the same time, the Grand Central was organizing a show to send to Venice, see? And he asked me to send this picture over. I sent reflections over there.
That was the first one, or the second one, that you sent?
The second one, the second that I thought was the best.
Mm-hmm.
I went there. Because Minigro had seen the other and invited that. So, in due time, they reported from the Grand Central that the modern men had raised such a rumpus because there weren't enough of them included in the shipment that it created a row, and the paper had got a hold of it, and they'd just given up the whole project and did a mine if they hung my picture in their galleries for a while. And I said, no, go ahead. And in due time, they wrote and said, we wish you'd come over here and see this picture of yours. We've hung it in a gallery by itself. I think it'll please you. Meanwhile, Minigrode had called up and asked me. I had put $7,000 on that too, see? And called up and asked what I'd take for that for the gallery. And I said, I'd take $6,000 for it, see? And they said, would I take back one that I'd already sold them as partial payment? I said, I would. And that one, I think, was $1,800, was a smaller and earlier thing. So their committee then decided that they wanted that for their permanent collection, and it was all settled. And Mr. Hines in Washington, D.C., a senator from Colorado, who had made a lot of money and was retired to Washington, he came in, and they were in the room together, and he saw this picture that they'd just bought for mine for the gallery. And he said, look, he said, you've got plenty of time to get a red field. Now, I said, I'd like to have that. It would just suit me for the house. And Minnegrode wrote and told me about this, but said they've decided to keep it. So I wrote and told him, I said, look, I said, I'm going to send a picture that's in New York. Meanwhile, I've been over and saw it. And it simply floored me, the way it was hung with the butternut-colored velvet curtains, back of it in the right light. My God, just thought it looks as worth $1 million, even to me. So I sent it down there, and I said, I said, in the first place, you folks look at it alongside of your picture. I think it's better than what you have. And if you'll release that picture to Mr. Himes and take that, fine and dandy. And if you don't want it, show it to Mr. Himes. So they decided they'd keep theirs. They have it to this day. Called Mr. Himes in, he thought, heavens, he said, that's for me. He said, I like it better than the other one. And he paid $7,000. That was, I always figured that I got $13,000 in 2 days. And that's high.
Well, that was
that's high water mark. With
that
me.
Was a good day's work.
In about 14 and a half hours' work. And the Panama Pacific, I had the same problem. I've had it in plenty of places. And I run into a funny one. I run into Pennell. Pennell has made up his mind to give the gold medal. This is before he sees any pictures at all. He wanted to give the grand gold medal to Cecilia Bowe. As he stated to me, he said, I'm sick and tired of seeing John Singer Sargent get this thing. And he said, it's about time somebody else got it. So told him, this was over in New York at the Century Club dining. I said, as far as I go, I like to look at the pictures before I give any medals. And I let it drop at that. Joe Pennell went to out west, not with a crowd. He went a week ahead. The rest of us went by San Diego to see the exposition. And then on up, Paul Barton, Mrs. Bartlett, all that outfit was there, Chase, Gravely, the whole damn business. Alden Weir, the wife, daughter, two daughters, and a darn fine chap he was, too.
Oh, I should say.
He's a honey.
I liked his work, and yeah. I always liked him.
So, you couldn't beat him. We got out there on the very first evening. We were to be entertained at the Bohemian Club, one of the finest clubs he's ever been. Because it was truly a Bohemian club in the best sense of the word. They had great talent. They had good singers, and the art end of things weren't tremendous. They had McComas, a New Zealand man that did watercolors very well, and a man by the name of Matthews that painted figures. He wasn't particularly bad, but there were very few of them. And here was Pennell there, and he was surrounded by people from Juraman, from Brazil and Cuba and various countries in South America had all sent their contributions, and each their man, their juryman, to represent him and that sort of thing. He had them all at a table there. And when we foregathered around the big table to have this big affair, he started in and he said, well, we have decided, referring to these South American compatriots, that the best thing to do regarding the exhibition, I said, look, Pennell, I said, don't you think it'd be a good thing before you decide anything to have the other 30 men get together and decide what we're going to do? He started to stutter. He said, you know what, where your place is? He said, you go back to Center Bridge and eat peanuts, that's where you belong. So I said, all right, Jojo. I was calling Jojo, you know, with these whiskers. I said, wait till it's all over and see what you think. So he was going to bull everything, you know. He's going to give out the prize and everything in God's world. Trask was there, of course, and Harshy was his assistant and all all that sort of thing. And I'd had considerable to do with organizing the show and working on East with the various committees. And I thought I knew something about it, too. I generally do, as far as that goes. I'm not modest in that respect at all. So Pennell started right in, you know, telling everybody how he thought we should do it, how it should be done, and so on and so forth. Well, I said to me, I think the easiest way and the simplest way and the proper way is to have the watercolor men judge the watercolors and pastels, the miniature men, that sort of thing, the black and white, that sort of thing, the sculptors, their things, and the oil painters, theirs, the various things. And each division elect their chairman, and then they do their work in those rooms, the watercolors, the black and white. Well, he was wild. He didn't want to be, he was a black and white man, yeah, of course, essentially, but he didn't want to be in the black and white. Yeah. He wanted to be out with the oil painters, and yeah, he was going to do the Cecilia Bow stuff and the whole damn business, you know. So he finally was defeated on a vote, and they went off. And I saw Philip Hale and Paxson working openly to get gold medals for their wives, either of them. Both of them were very fair women,
yeah,
painters,
yeah,
as far as it went. And I objected. I objected out loud. Let everybody know how I felt about that sort of thing. I said, no matter how good their work was, I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And they know me, they knew me very well. Wasn't offended in any way. And then finally, the final thing is that the whole jury then goes around to the various rooms and the various departments, black and white, what have you, and either okays what that department has done or suggests some change if they want to, as a whole thing, if they think things haven't been just the way they should be, either as to placement or anything else. So we got over, we went around, things went pretty smooth. We got over to where the miniatures were. I never claimed to know anything about miniatures in particular. I think maybe I know a good one when I see it, possibly. So I just stood there. They read their list and went around. You see these little things one after the other. And I was browsing around, just looking at them. And I said to myself, damn, I think this one is just as good as the one I gave a medal to over here. And I said to him, I said, well, what's the matter with this one over here? I said, that looks just as good to me as some of these. And so I proposed it for a medal. And it carried, got a medal. Trask started to laugh. He said, gentlemen, he said, you've heard, Reddy, they call me, protest against the awards that these men were voting for their wives. He said, I just tell you the name of the artist that made this miniature is Heloise Redfield.
You never seen it.
Thank God, the damnedest thing I ever run into. I had,
yeah,
the funny part was,
for a few minutes, I'll bet you.
I had met this Heloise Redfield once. She was a student at the Academy of Fine Arts, and I was in there one day looking at the exhibition. She came up and introduced herself. Name was Redfield. She knew I was Redfield, and asked me which branch I came down and that sort of thing, and I told her. She said her father was either a naturalist or a scientist. Don't know which now. And they lived in West Philadelphia, and there's a street out there named after him to this day. There's always been this dreadful confusion as to who landed first.
You or Mr. Later.
Of course, it was all damn nonsense from A to Z. Later perfectly honest about it, because when he landed here, he didn't find me here, see. I had been here for a year damn near, and I lost this child and took my wife to France because she's going down as a living skeleton. It was during that period he blew in. And he didn't come here on account of me, he come here through Dr. Marshall. He didn't know any more about me than I knew about him.
Mm.
And he always thought, I think to the end, that he came here first. Dr. Marshall came up and talked to me about it towards the end. And I told him just what happened. I said, Lord, anybody that wants to go up Doylestown, they can see the deed when I bought the property. In May.
Was that this property?
No, the property above. I bought this island up here with a mortgage of $3,000 on it. It wasn't worth $3,000.
What year was that? Place.
That was in 98.
98. And you were here a year living on the island?
Well, no, I always lived this side. I put my father on the island.
Oh, yeah.
He was a farmer originally, and he had to turn in every damn thing he owned on account of some of these.
Is that the island that Miss Miller used to?
Oh, yes. I sold it to the Millers.
I've got a tale I could tell you about that island.
Yeah, I sold it to the Millers.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah. I got tired of putting up fences that the Freshets tore down all the time, and I only got $4,500 out of it. That's all. So they got it cheap enough, but...
So then you came here in 98?
Huh?
You came here in 98?
Yeah. When I got back from France, I landed back here with 35 cents in my pocket.
That was 1900 or 1901?
That was in 1900. Because 99, Laurent was born, see.
In France?
He was born in France at Alfort, and he was the first child that was born after we lost this girl who was 4 years and a half old. And he was born in France. And we saw the exposition of 1900, and we came back that fall. I was so poor when I came up here that...
The second time. Or the first?
Oh, well, I was poor both times. See, Father had failed. And I sold these pictures to this man, Pfeiffer, in Philadelphia. He was supposed to be a collector, and he told me, he said, made me think his damn sight better than they were, of course. In fact, you don't have to tell youth much about how wonderful their work is. They all think it's wonderful as soon as they can stick a brush on a canvas. But as you get older, why, you learn a hell of a sight more about what's what in that respect. But one of the first things, what got me on this Who Come Here First style, is one of the first things I run into was a picture that was painted at Point Pleasant and it's signed Carl Weber. Now that's way ahead when we were here. And then there was this man Hid up here who was an academician in the 50s.
Yes.
Lived in, was the father of Head up here that had the...
Lived in Lumberville.
Post office in Lumberville.
Yes.
And then Innes painted the valley well up early when he was still painting outside and doing something besides those stinking autumn things that he did. But when he went outside and painted one, I want to tell you he painted some good ones.
Mr. Redfield, I'll never get out a second edition of this, but this is what I say about you. Edward Willis Redfield first came to the area in the summer of 1887 when he and other young men camped for a while on Bull's Island opposite Lumberville.
That is correct.
After studying in France and acquiring a French wife, he returned for good in 1898.
Returned to where?
Returned for good
in
1898.
Yeah.
Buying what is known as Hendricks Island near Center Bridge and later establishing his home and studio on the mainland opposite.
Yeah.
Of the fine artists who came here at the turn of the century, Mr. Redfield, Elizabeth Friedland, and M. Elizabeth Price alone remain. A member of the National Institute of Arts and Letters and of the National Academy of Design, Mr. Redfield has won more prizes and has hung in more permanent collections than any of his successors. There is hardly a major prize that has escaped him. Among the some 25 galleries where his work may be seen are the Luxembourg, Metropolitan, Corcoran, and Carnegie.
Yeah.
Is that all accurate?
One in the Metropolitan is seldom seen, and it's the Rotter. Do you ever see those catalogs he sends out? Is
no.
The stuff they're exhibiting? Before we go out, I'll show you one. By golly, of all the scratches and pimples that they frame now, and call pictures and award medals to.
Oh, well.
Well, I say to everybody, I don't care whether you're a modern painter or who it is. If you come in here, I'll tell you what I think of it. I always say the same thing. Take a baby's diaper when it's had a good passage and frame it and send it out, has just as much merit as anything the two boys are making, in my judgment.